When it comes to weight loss, no two people are the same. That's why Noom builds personalized plans based on your unique psychology and biology. Take Brittany. After years of unsustainable diets, Noom helped her lose 20 pounds and keep it off.
I was definitely in a yo-yo cycle for years of just losing weight, gaining weight, and it was exhausting.
And Stephanie. She's a former D1 athlete who knew she couldn't out-train her diet, and she lost 38 pounds.
My relationship to food before Noom was never consistent.
And Evan, he can't stand salads, but he still lost 50 pounds with Noom.
I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. Even through the pickiness, Noom taught me that building better habits builds a healthier lifestyle. I'm not doing this to get to a number. I'm doing this to feel better.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom users compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Stahl. I'm Slate's jurisprudence editor. Ordinarily, I edit our courts and legal coverage from the comfort of my home office in Los Angeles, but for the next month and a half, I will be locked in a lower Manhattan courtroom with the rest of the press, a jury of 12 New Yorkers, Justice Juan Merchan, prosecutors, Trump's defense team, and the former president himself as history unfolds. I've temporarily moved myself and my family from Los Angeles to New York to cover this case firsthand, like I have done in other cases, including the Paul Manafort case, the Roger Stone criminal trial, and Donald Trump's first impeachment. I'm hoping that my background knowledge of the many, many criminal travails of our former president can offer something to you, Slate's listener. Over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from me on Amicus, Slate's legal podcast, and in articles on Slate.com. From the jury selection, to the opening arguments, to the witness testimony and cross-examination, and the prosecution's case and the defense's case, and ultimately to a final verdict. We will be providing you wall-to-wall coverage throughout the entirety of the trial as it unfolds from the courtroom. There's no way I'd be able to do it without the support of Slate Plus. So if you're not already a subscriber, please join today by clicking try free at the top of the Amicus show page on Apple Podcasts or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. Thank you so, so much.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title the Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
The Slate Political Gabfest is sponsored by Stamps.com. Buy and print official U.S. postage using your own computer and printer and save up to 80% compared to a postage meter. Sign up for a no-risk trial and a $110 bonus offer when you visit Stamps.com and use the promo code GABFEST. And by Sundance Now Doc Club, the new streaming service for everyone who loves documentaries. Discover unforgettable films like The Queen of Versailles, The Staircase, and The Weather Underground. To get a free 30-day trial, go to docclub.com/gabfest. That's docclub.com/gabfest. And by Trunk Club. Answer a few simple questions about your look, style, and size, and receive a trunk full of great-looking clothes that fit perfectly and make you look amazing. Only pay for the clothes you keep with no ongoing subscription, and shipping is free. Go to trunkclub.com/gabfest.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for July 24th, 2015, the Who Will Donald Trump Insult Next edition. I'm David Plotz of Atlas Obscura here in Washington, D.C. Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine. Hello, you're in New Haven.
Hello, hello.
Where there apparently is a tape delay.
There is it. Are you delayed, Emily?
No, I wasn't delayed. I thought you were going to say something else, so I was like waiting for the rest
you
of the
You wanted some praise, some compliment, some observation.
I just thought you sort of, you were upspeaking, or I don't know, maybe it was just in my mind.
I do. I do have a terrible upspeak. John Dickerson of Face the Nation is here, down speaking. Hello, John.
Hello, David. I'm all right.
John has printouts of men with extreme mustachios and facial hair.
Well, that's funny you mention that. We'll get to that when the time comes.
I love facial hair and mustachios. If you haven't had a chance to listen to John's new Whistle Stop podcast about the Ted Kennedy versus Jimmy Carter primary fight in 1980, whew, it's a doozy. It's only part one of two, but it's so great. You got to listen to it. But that's not what we're talking about today. We are talking today about whether we have reached peak Trump and whether John Kasich has a chance in the GOP primary race. Our second topic will be Black Lives Matter, Democratic candidates, and Sandra Bland's death. We will tie all those things together. Then we will talk about Obama's secret plan to close Guantanamo Bay. Plus, we'll have cocktail chatter, and in Slate Plus, we will go deep on Wisconsin politics and road building with a special guest. It is the Today in Badger State Infrastructure podcast you have been waiting for all your life, which John Dickerson probably already subscribes to. John?
I have that, and plus I have the beer koozie that is given out to supporters of that podcast.
Today in Beer Koozie podcast.
Only, you can only use it for lining Kugels, though.
If you are not yet a Slate Plus member, you can get it by going to slate.com/GabFestPlus. If we were giving out a swag prize for being a listener to the show, what would it be? I don't really know. It doesn't feel like there's any object.
We don't, right. It's true. We're
not about material.
It's weird.
We're not material people. It's very, very intellectual. What we would give out
Maybe people have an idea that they could write in and say, this is what you would give away, because we're not thinking of it, but they have a better sense of us than we do.
They think of objects. All right, Donald Trump. Oh, boy. Donald Trump. Oh, my goodness. The Donald Trump moment of the week for me, this was when not one but two different media companies within minutes of each other rolled out the Donald Trump insult generator.
Yeah. Who was the other one other than Time?
Mother Jones also had one. So
all of which is the birth child of the John Travolta
name generator. Yeah. But it was just amazing. So my Donald Trump insult was, why does David Plotz constantly seek out trivial nonsense? And then there was the New Republic.
That's a good one for you.
It is. It was pretty good. The New Republic also then created a Trump compliment generator, which was, David Plotz is strong, smart, tough, vicious, violent, all the ingredients you need to be an entrepreneur.
That doesn't capture the Trump, amazing Trump-like sentence structure, which would, it needs to have, use fewer words and have them connected by less cartilage. It needs to be, you know, David Plotz, great guy. I know him. He loves me. I have lots of David Plotzes. Staunch, you know, just like words thrown out.
They're undiagrammable sentences.
Yeah, undiagrammable, with a central tent post being how much the topic loves Donald Trump, or how many of the topic work for Donald Trump. A colleague of mine at CBS, Steve Shigaris, came up with a very good idea, which was to pair Trump's comments with North Korean propaganda, because there's a certain similar, like, so over the top. It's like my father. Every meal, my father, it's the best hamburger he's ever had. Right. And that's...
Right. Right. All right. In basic Trump news this week, he insulted John McCain by saying he preferred war heroes who didn't get captured. He insulted Lindsey Graham and released Lindsey Graham's cell phone number. He insulted Anderson Cooper, Rupert Murdoch, I think. Plenty of media. And we'll also bracket, or not bracket, we're just going to note that we're also going to talk about John Kasich, who's starting a presidential campaign.
We're going to pretend that we're talking about John Kasich, just as John wrote, we're already overwhelmed by Trump because he's such a gift that keeps giving.
So, Emily, is this McCain insult? I think when it happened, people thought, oh, that's it. It's fatal. Where Trump is, it's just going to be a shattering, you know, cataclysmic descent. But was it at all? Does this affect him at all?
I don't think it's fatal. The polls that were taken that reflected the insult, he had lower voter support than before. So that was like a relief to most human beings on the planet, I suppose. But I think the media interest in Trump is only going to continue. He obviously is having the time of his life. And there are a group of voters for whom his, you know, tell truth to power stance is really compelling. I also think it's so early. I mean, if a pollster calls you right now and says, who do you support for president? It must feel like, you know, you're playing a game of Monopoly. Who cares what you say? It doesn't have any real world implications. You can have whatever fantasy you want about a presidential candidate right now. It seems very harmless. And so it just seems like he's going to keep going. In fact, maybe the more outrageous he is, the better for his ability to stay with enough support, certainly to make the presidential debate, but also just to keep the spotlight on.
If you have as much money as he has and you're willing to say outlandish things, I mean, look at the coverage he got when he said the president wasn't born in the United States. He wasn't a candidate. He was just a guy with a lot of money saying outrageous things who had notoriety. And he got, you know, he was swarmed by cameras in his visit to New Hampshire, just as he's being swarmed by cameras as he goes to Laredo. This is a, you know, passion for the entertainment of Trump. So it's a media story on the one hand, which is what's the responsibility here of the media. But also, it's not just the media. If you look at the Google searches for candidates, the Washington Post did a great graph of Google searches for Trump's name during the period around John Kasich's announcement. And so for Kasich, the graph hangs right along the horizontal axis and then spikes about the time he announces and then goes quickly back down. It looks like Mount Kilimanjaro. Trump is just one huge, massive plateau at almost the peak level Kasich ever got to. It is still the press's fault for obsessing beyond. Somebody compiled a list of all the pundits who had weighed in on Trump, and it was something like 168 pundits, different pundits had weighed in on Trump in a very short period of time, like 24 hours. So obviously the obsession is in the media, but it also, the obsession is abroad in the land.
Yeah, I don't think, why do we say it's in the media if the, by almost any reasonable standard, the press is undercovering Trump when you consider how much more interested the public is in Trump than they are in these other candidates?
Well, I guess the media gets criticized for covering him out of proportion with the rest of the news and also out of proportion with his ultimate chances as a nominee. And also,
well,
it depends on what the standard
is. But if you're leading the polls, then that doesn't that end all the discussion about whether you're being overcovered? I mean, I've been feeling like a couple weeks ago I acted all, I'm above talking about this because he'll never be elected and this is a big distraction. And that was, I've been proved completely wrong. Now he's leading the polls. How are we supposed to ignore him?
John, I'm interested in you. You study these polls. You go to bed at night, wife on one side, polls on the other. When you look at these poll data, which show him at, you know, twice where Scott Walker and Jeb Bush are, 24%, they're around 12, do you make anything of it? Do you think it hasn't accounted for whatever the McCain hit will be? Or do you think these are meaningful numbers?
I think they're meaningful only in that they register what we've always known, which is that there is a group of people in the conservative movement who are very angry with Washington, who don't like elites in either party, but don't like elites in their party, don't like the elites and the smarty pants people in the press. And Trump is an embodiment of that and a vehicle of that. And so when people are asked, they're all down for Trump. Does that mean they want him to be president? For a much smaller group within that group, the answer is yes. But for a lot, he is just acting as a kind of guttural punch at all of those things I named before. And so they're all for that. Also, there's a kind of consistency in the way this happens both in Democratic and Republican politics, which is that there is a Howard Dean type or Michelle Bachmann or who really excites the bases of the party. And the bases of the party kind of pay more attention at the beginning of the process and are more active at the beginning of the process. So these kinds of candidates have a big summer flourish. And then after a while, the party settled back to a kind of position more towards the middle of where their party is. And so I think this is an accurate snapshot of a certain segment of the party, but I don't think it has any predictive value or has any tells us much about these people's thinking about the presidency as much as it is a kind of way for them to register an anger, a disappointment, an approval of certain kinds of things that he's doing when he talks about the border or when he talks about America. You know, they want to hear somebody who says we win all the time. And that's a pleasing message after so much time of kind of confusion and their view that America is on the decline.
So
So whose thunder is Trump stealing? Is it Rand Paul? Who would be this candidate if it weren't him?
No, I think it's Ted Cruz. I think it's a more of a Tea Party than a Libertarian. We should note that Donald Trump, in the course of his time, has donated to Hillary Clinton, was pro-life, in favor of universal health care, has voted for Democrats. I mean, he has a series of positions that are totally antithetical to the conservative movement. He has no, other than the border, he has no set of positions. I mean, he's against the Iran deal. But his response in one of the speeches this week about the Iran deal was like a, I don't know whether there was poetry. It didn't really hang together. It was a series of sentences, like it's like refrigerator poetry. So it's not like he has a particular agenda other than, I mean, on the border, and he went back there to Laredo on Thursday because there is a feeling among people, hey, you know, he's really saying what I believe, even though the number of Mexican immigrants has gone down considerably and all of that, there is this anger and he's channeling
that. So do you guys think that if you are a Republican Party poobah, if you're Jeb Bush, if you're a Koch brother, that you should just let this fire burn itself out, or that the party actually does need to take steps to try to do something to rein him in, to get him to stop talking? It's hard to see what it would be since he has infinite amounts of money and a core of popular support, but
there's no way they can leave him out of the debates at this point, is there?
No.
But something else. Is there other things that is there anything that the Republican Party establishment can do if it wanted to try to?
I don't think so. And just to answer, I don't think I answered your question, Emily, about who this takes from. I mean, I think it takes from.
You said Ted Cruz.
I guess I did. Okay, phew. I think also, but there's a second part of it, which is that to the extent that Trump riles up a lot of people, gets them involved who wouldn't otherwise have participated in Republican primaries or caucuses. And those people, once agitated by the Trump message, find themselves with extra energy left to take them into the voting booth in those contests when they would not have otherwise. He then brings more people onto the field who other candidates can pick up. And I think that's where some of the reluctance from some candidates have been in terms of going like fully after him, although that number who haven't done so is basically down to just Paul and Cruz. But I think the question of getting him out of the party has now taken on a new, although it was always there, but it's now, because of remarks he's made recently, gotten a little bit more dangerous for the Republican Party. As he's talked about, you know, depending on how the Republican Party treats me, I may go independent. And I mean, this is somebody smarter than me and who understands how to use important sociological terms to characterize these kinds of relationships would have a field day, because there is an element in which Trump is like the boyfriend or girlfriend you had, in which where it was quite passionate and there were love letters exchanged, and then everything went wrong, and then it got quite ugly. And in the context of the ugliness, the boyfriend or girlfriend started publishing the lovely things you said about them, and then in retaliation, you started publishing the lovely things that they had said about you, and this is what's happening. I mean, so Trump gives away Lindsey Graham's phone number after Lindsey Graham called him a jackass, and talks about how Graham was so groveling at one point that he called up Trump and asked him to just mention his name on Fox News. Then Rick Perry, same thing, but then Rick Perry posted a bunch of tweets from Donald Trump back when Perry was running, saying how wonderful Perry was, and ran some video on it. And so anyway, the extension of this breakup scenario is that Trump, if he feels mistreated by the Republican establishment, would run as an independent. And the danger there, of course, is the Ross Perot model, where he steals votes from Republicans and ends up electing Hillary Clinton. And so he has got this hold over the party that I'm sure has there's some great term for it that already exists.
Yeah, he's got their nuts in a vise.
Abuse.
that was the hand gesture you were making.
Yeah. Well, but mine was more like a puppeteer, but you may have intuited it beyond.
David brought it right down where he is most comfortable.
I'm actually surprised, just going to this, where did he steal from, or who is he hurting, that we have seen a little bit less crazy from some of these other candidates than you would have expected. I'm surprised that these guys aren't doing more.
You even coined a whole verb for them, and it's like they haven't been quite using it the way you were hoping.
No, but it is surprising, I think, that you don't have Rand Paul or Bobby Jindal. Maybe Bobby Jindal is doing crazy things, and just because Trump has all the oxygen, no one hears it.
You'd be hard to out crazy Trump at the moment.
Well, that's the problem.
Yeah. And also, there is a certain genius in the way that he's playing the press. He's playing the Republican Party. I think if you talk to plenty of Republicans, they would argue, and Rick Perry said this explicitly in a speech, but the Wall Street Journal also in an editorial made this point, that Trump is playing the voters, that what he is doing, and this is the knock from the Wall Street Journal, is that he is playing on people's fears, that he's the classic demagogue, that he is playing on people's fears, offering them boogeymen that don't exist and solutions that are impossible, and in doing so are taking advantage of them and using the rage that he has cooked up in them for his own personal aggrandizement. And that is an extraordinary critique, comparing him to George Wallace, Strom Thurmond.
Well, can you imagine, but truly, can you imagine a regular person who behaved like Donald Trump in their regular goings about that this person didn't have $1 billion and media covering them? You'd think this person is the biggest asshole there is. He just has nothing but vicious things to say about people. He brags about himself all the time. He doesn't listen to anybody else. When you think about what is a troll, Donald Trump is the embodiment of trollishness. And yet, because in the world of digital media, and if there's a constituency for it, people pay attention to it, when in real life you would just go as far away from this person as you could possibly be, because it's so toxic to be around him.
And I think that's going back to your question about the polls. I think that's obviously the limit of the troll candidacy. Is the troll candidacy excites, and this is not unlike trolling everywhere, which is that some people applaud the troll in social media, but then there's a ceiling to that. And in this case, Trump's negatives are quite firm in polls, both nationally and in battleground states. He has, you know, basically 2-to-1 negatives. His behavior is not conducive to reversing that, which is to say people won't say, oh, you know, at first I thought he was a jerk, but now I really see that he's this other wonderful thing. Now, the follow-on question that's interesting is Hillary Clinton's negatives, at least on the Quinnipiac poll in Iowa, Colorado, and Virginia, are just basically as high. His are 57 and hers 56 in terms of negative feelings. That's kind of interesting to me.
Are you calling Hillary Clinton a troll candidate?
No, I'm not. But I'm just saying if it stands that his negatives are an impediment to his reaching a larger audience, then why wouldn't hers be? I mean, there's an answer to that, but
let's quickly turn
to the answer. I mean, they are a problem, right? No, not talking about the answer.
Well, no, they are a problem, but she can have negatives, but has a larger constituency than he does, at least at the moment.
Right. And I think she hopes that her negatives will move.
And she's got a chance,
incredibly,
right? And she's got a chance for her negatives to move.
Just quickly on Kasich. So, Emily, what chance, if any? John Kasich, he's the liberal media's favorite Republican this time. He's occupying the John Huntsman, John McCain kind of role, sort of the truth teller, appears to be willing
straight
to work.
Straight talker, willing to work. Super popular Ohio governor,
work with
somehow
people. Yeah,
totally
and another, you know, I don't want to understand is why he didn't run in 2012. I feel like if he'd run in 2012, we'd be thinking about him as a front runner today, that he might have had a better run then. Anyway, why he has no chance?
I have an idea for John Kasich. John should answer that, but then I'll present my wonderful plan.
Give your plan.
So I was trying to think yesterday about who Hillary Clinton's vice presidential slate is, and it didn't seem really obvious to me who she could choose. He's perfect. He's a white guy from the Midwest, a really popular governor of a swing state. I know he's a Republican.
He's really conservative.
I know, but I'm just saying, like, that's the sort of slot that he... See, when I figured that out, I felt... I mean,
is he
going to
support her abortion
based.
Or her abortion everywhere policies, Emily?
I don't... She doesn't have an abortion
just,
everywhere
just
policy.
Goading
access.
You.
Kasich's challenge is that... And I tried to write about this, and I wish I'd had, like, a week to write it, because I think there's a lot you can pack into such a story. But if we go back to that Google search graph... Kasich's challenge is being demonstrated by Donald Trump, which is that the process, both the media that covers the presidential politics and the people who are interested in presidential politics, are all gravitating towards Trump. And people can say they want to talk about the issues and can say a lot of things about the high-minded way they'd like to approach the presidential process, but the bus is being driven by the entertaining Mr. Trump. So if you were to look, though, just on paper, if you looked at the attributes for the job and which of the candidates have them, Kasich should be the one. If that were the totally and all you were thinking about, Kasich would do much better than Trump. Trump has been successful in the business world. There's very little evidence that success in the business world has a one-to-one correlation with success in the political world. Not to say that people in the business world haven't been successful in politics, but it's mostly been because they've adapted. Trump is not arguing that he can adapt. He's arguing that if he stays exactly the same.
What? You're talking about Trump again.
No, but I'm
just
Trump is arguing if he behaves exactly the same, he would be able to win over the political world. The reason John Kasich looks good on paper is that he's been successful not just in the executive realm, but in the congressional as well. He was the budget chairman for the last time the budget was balanced. He's a popular governor, almost 60% approval rating, the most popular of the Republican governors running in a battleground state. So he's shown at both the congressional and the executive level, he can work with the kind of people you would work with as president, which is to say other politicians. This isn't to say that he doesn't have flaws, but he's got the qualities you would kind of like in a president. But that's not the way campaigns are decided or how people figure their votes out. They figure them out based on all kinds of other stuff that doesn't really have anything to do with what you actually do in the job.
Oh, John Kasich, that was the 2 minutes that you get on the show. It was nice having you there.
We hope you make it into the debates.
Yes. Well, that's the thing, taking place in his own state. Ugh. He might not any, I mean, that just as a kind of hometown sadness, you know, for any governor running for president. You can't even get it on the debate stage in your own state.
GabFest is sponsored this week by Stamps.com. How great would it be if the post office was open 24-7? No more limited hours. You could get your mailing and shipping done on your schedule. And now you can when you use Stamps.com. You can print postage whenever you need it right from your desk. Stamps.com will save you the time and hassle of going to the post office. No more rushing there during your busy day. Just use your computer and printer to get official U.S. postage for any letter or package. Then your mail carrier picks it up. You'll save money with Stamps.com, too, because you can get the exact postage the instant you need it. No more overpaying. You can even get special postage discounts you can't get at the post office. Right now, use our promo code GABFEST for a special offer, a no-risk trial, and a $110 bonus offer, which includes up to $55 in free postage and a digital scale. Don't wait. Go to Stamps.com before you do anything else. Click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in GABFEST. That's Stamps.com. Enter GABFEST. Black Lives Matter, the movement sparked by Trayvon Martin's death and further fueled by the killing of Walter Scott and others, disrupted an appearance by Martin O'Malley and Bernie Sanders at Netroots Nation this week. The protester interrupted the two candidates and demanded that they acknowledge that Black Lives Matter, essentially. So, John, how did they each respond to that, and what did we learn from their response?
Well, so Hillary Clinton wasn't there, so she didn't respond really at all. But Bernie Sanders responded by saying, "I've been working for civil rights for 50 years," and tried to basically stop himself from being shouted down. It was the most tone deaf of the responses.
Really, worse than Martin O'Malley?
Well,
Martin
because O'Malley
didn't do himself a solid either.
Well, right. So, but O'Malley, I mean, I'm basing this based on not having watched it in real time, but based on just what I've read about the event. O'Malley didn't try to blow through the heckling and the but tried to say, yes, I hear you. But then he said, Black lives matter, white lives matter, you know, all lives matter. And as Jamel wrote in Slate, the disconnect here was, he said, it's like if you go to a breast cancer awareness march and say breast cancer matters and so does prostate cancer, it kind of misses the fundamental point at the center. And then O'Malley kind of tried to fix it in his remarks and then fix it in his remarks later. So in the totality of the moment, O'Malley was seen to have done better in answering this question, which is basically, or this debate, which is basically between race and class, and recognizing that for those who make this argument that unless you address race specifically head on its own terms, that addressing, you know, health care or lack of health care or economic opportunity is kind of missing the point. That's sometimes the answer people give in response to the Black Lives Matter campaign.
Emily, what should you do when confronted with implacable hecklers, numerous implacable hecklers at a public event who are demanding that you just simply say something? What are you supposed to do?
You figure out a way to recognize the continuing power of racism, especially in the criminal justice system, since that's the kind of edge of this. And then I think you also acknowledge the history. You know, President Obama did a pretty good job a few weeks ago when he talked about racism being in the country's DNA. That wasn't a direct response to a heckler, but it's part of, I think, what Black Lives Matter, that movement, is asking for right now. It's recognition of this kind of underlying reality that affects all kinds of aspects of American government, and in particular the criminal justice system, in a way that we have tended to underplay.
Right. No, I'm not. I guess I wasn't talking about the actual virtues of the issue. I'm literally talking tactically. You're someone is yelling.
Yeah, policy no, it was
very
answer.
Earnest. It's true. No, very earnest and persuasive. Yes, but I'm just saying tactically, you're somewhere and someone is demanding that you say something, which you may well agree with, and you're flustered because your heartbeat is racing. And you're this is not the panel that you signed up for. What are you? What did
oh,
you?
Right.
What
so
are you
how
supposed
do you handle that?
Do
well. Ideally, you have some kind of deft, light touch, some way of deflecting it, or you say like, "This is confusing." You kind of acknowledge your own confusion in the moment about what to do, and hope that they'll take pity on you. Or I guess the third thing is like you just agree with it, but that seems risky to me because you don't want to get goaded into taking a position that you haven't thought through. John, what's a better response?
I don't know. I don't know what the better response is. So tough in those instances where
there's the room and then
there's
the
room.
Future and the
exactly.
World,
there's
right?
the room. There's the world. You're not quite sure why they're yelling, what they're like. Also, in contemporary politics, there are two other kind of bigger problems outside of the specific ones we're talking about, which is that politicians are all ever more focused on keeping things small, which is to say only what they're there to talk about and only what they've rehearsed talking about, and they take less risks. I mean, in the old days when politicians spoke, they said all kinds of stuff and they careered around the stage and had all kinds of crazy notions, and sometimes they said stupid stuff because they were just thinking out loud and being normal human beings. You're not allowed to be a normal human being and misspeak. You're not allowed to say something in shorthand that doesn't actually represent your views, but you just shorthanded it because you're busy, because you're trying to get to another thought. None of that stuff is allowed anymore because it can be grabbed, and then whatever people decide is the thing you meant is whatever you meant, even if you'd had a career of saying the opposite. So everybody's terrified about saying anything wrong. So when a surprise moment like this comes, they all freak out. So I don't know what the tactical – how to be successful tactically. I would say, though, that often on the right, when – candidate like John McCain, who, you know, was pro-life but didn't spend a lot of time thinking about abortion politics. Whenever he would be quizzed with one of these kind of surprise moment trick questions, you know, if your daughter came to you and said she was going to have an abortion, what would you do? You know, so you're supposed to know the answer to that. But if you don't, you kind of puzzle through it out loud. Bad. You can't puzzle through it out loud. You have to have thought this through at length before. And it would have been interesting to see what Hillary Clinton would have done in a similar circumstance, because she has given a speech about sentencing reform, about voting rights. And so she has come closer to the cluster of issues that are, I mean, obviously police brutality is what's at the center of this, but she's given speeches closer. And O'Malley, too, like, given he was a mayor of Baltimore, should have had like stuff at the ready. I guess my point, though, is if you thought about this aforehand, you would have a kind of riff in your back pocket just through previous experience that you would be able to avail yourself of.
What do you guys think about this Black Lives Matter as a political issue for Democrats? It's obviously very important to a critical part of the Democratic presidential base. I mean, African-American voters are huge percentage of the Democratic vote in general election, and they need high black turnout in the general election to win. Are there downside risks to this issue, to taking it too enthusiastically? Emily, what do you think?
I mean, I think a lot of white people have been, a lot of white liberals are sympathetic to Black Lives Matter. And the more, I don't mean to say this in a mercenary way, but the more we see these disturbing videotapes, the more it seems to me like it is not just an issue that is going to galvanize African-American voters. At the same time, if it's all you talk about or you seem super focused on it, you know, it is one of a panoply of issues, not to the people who are giving their lives to the activism, but to a candidate. And so in that sense, you have to have a sense of proportion, I suppose. John, do you think there's a bigger risk here I'm not laying out?
No, I think, so the biggest risk for the Democratic nominee is that somehow they get on the wrong side of a large portion of the African-American community and are not able to turn them out in the general election. In a sense, African-Americans are a part of the Democratic coalition. You don't want to lose an important part of your coalition. So a lot of things have to happen for that to happen, which is to say that the Black Lives Matter movement has to represent the entirety of the African-American vote, as opposed to just a vocal minority. So that would be the first thing that would have to happen. Secondly, then the choice would have to be so benign that somebody would say, well, it doesn't matter who becomes president. In other words, if Ted Cruz is the Republican nominee or somebody who's considered, maybe not Cruz, but somebody who's considered super conservative and therefore is going to support a bunch of policies that would disproportionately hurt the African-American community as they see it, then this is an important issue. But I really want Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders, whoever the nominee is, to be president, so I'm not going to stay home. And then you have to have a candidate who really screws up on the answer, whose answer is so bad that it would cause people to stay home. You know, it would cause enough people to stay home. So a lot of stuff has to happen for this to be truly damaging. But I think you, to give you some sense of how important Hillary Clinton thinks the African American vote is, look at what she's doing in South Carolina, how aggressively she's organizing the state and how hard she's working the state. She doesn't have any competition in the state. Bernie Sanders just isn't playing there. And nevertheless, Clinton is working that state very hard for a couple of reasons. One, large African-American population. If she can succeed and do well there with African-Americans, she can build on the tactics used to reach the vote there that she can then extrapolate and use in battleground states. She can also just say to other African-American, the African-American vote really turned out for me because they love me, and that helps her build her coalition for that general election. One other small piece of South Carolina, which has nothing to do with the conversation we're having, but what's interesting is conservative women might be interested in Hillary Clinton because that's a group for her to pick up in other states too, possibly just on purely a gender question. But that doesn't have anything to do with Black Lives Matter.
So, Emily, why is it that the Sandra Bland case, young woman in Texas, pulled over for just feeble at best reasons,
and pulled out of her car
ended up in a very violent confrontation with a very aggressive cop who lied about the nature of the encounter, and then she herself ended up dead of apparent suicide. Why is this case, where there's no unclear allegation of direct police involvement in her death, why has this galvanized people? What is it about this case that you think captures people's imagination and makes them so angry?
Oh, the videotape is so upsetting to watch. And I think what really got to me about it was I felt like she had read the playbook for Black Lives Matter. She understood that what was happening to her was this really fishy police encounter, and she was trying to assert her rights and kind of stand up for herself. And it just like completely 100% backfired. And you feel watching the video that if a cop decides that he doesn't like you, your only choice is to be as humble and compliant as possible. There's no room for questioning or rebellion. And I guess, you know what also really got me is the encounter starts with the policeman saying to her, "Are you okay?" in a voice that sounded actually like he cared about the answer. And then she says, "Yeah, I'm a little irritated. I was changing lanes because I thought you were behind me and you wanted me to change lanes," essentially. And then it's like it just flips. And in the moment where he asks her to put out her cigarette and she says, "I'm in my own car, I don't have to," that answer triggered something in him that he just had to put her down, that was defiance he couldn't stand for. And from there, it just escalates. And I guess the only lesson I feel like I learned from watching this is like, the police tell you to do something, you do it. You don't think about whether it's illegal. You don't think about your constitutional rights. You just obey. And that is the wrong answer in this country. That should not be how it works.
How should it be?
How should it be?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, we have constitutional rights. The police can't make you do anything at all. They can't stop you if they have no reasonable suspicion. There are legal standards that they're supposed to be abiding by, and they can't just like yank you out of the car forcibly because they feel like it. The problem is that, and Orrin Kerr wrote, I thought, a really good post about this on the Volokh conspiracy blog. You don't know in that moment what the cop is thinking and whether they have reason to suspect you of doing something. And even if they're wrong, like maybe some witness said you had done something that you hadn't actually done. And so because of that, it's basically impossible to safely assert your constitutional rights. And that's infuriating.
Yeah. No, but is the answer that you should assert your constitutional rights, or is the answer that actually you should just be completely compliant because you cannot win any individual encounter? While it's clear societally we need to fix this problem, that you as an individual in any individual encounter, the overwhelming chance is that you're going to be on the wrong side of it. Like, there's not a lot of individual
games. But I also feel like if every single one of us never challenges the police in that moment, we don't fix the societal problem, right? That's the problem. But my instinct in the moment with the police is, and I mean, obviously, like, I don't think that I pose a threat. But I got pulled over a few weeks ago. It was like ridiculous. I was on the highway, but I pulled over actually to do some work. So I got out of my car because it was hot. So I had pulled onto the shoulder, which I guess was probably, it was probably not okay to be there. And I was like sitting on the side, like desperately typing. I mean, is this the nerdiest image in the entire world? And a policeman pulled over and I started shaking. I was like, oh no, now they're going to like take me. I don't know, whatever. Even just give me a ticket. Like, oh, I just have to file this story. This is awful. And so I was immediately like, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I'll move right now. I'm so sorry. And the cop was like confused. He was like, well, what are you doing there? And I explained, he was like, oh, well, that's, you can be. But it just, I was all ready to be, you know, just as meek as possible to get out of the encounter. And I suppose that's the safest thing to do, but I don't think it's like the best thing to do.
To me, the most shocking part of the Sandra Bland story actually is not, it's neither her death nor the stop, both of which the mystery of her death will discover or not. Yeah. But it's the fact that you can be pulled over for fucking changing lanes and be in jail for 3 days.
That's terrifying. She had $5,000 bond to post, right? That's a lot. Because once it escalated and she's, you know, then she is facing misdemeanor charges for like disrupting or disturbing the officer or whatever it was.
Right.
And
she wasn't in jail for 3 days because of the lane change.
Yeah, I know. But okay.
Oh, you mean that?
No,
it can,
but that is
can,
really
yeah,
what
and then
it was.
They can trump up,
yeah,
but they can also can trump up whatever
well,
they want.
Always
they
do,
always
yeah.
say you resisted arrest and it's going to take a while to figure out. I mean, this cop's going to lose his job. This cop's going to be, you know, this cop has totally screwed his own life, but he did.
Right. Which is. Right. It's so sad because ultimately she'll be vindicated. And I suppose the good thing about these videos is that even if you're compliant in the moment, you could win in the end. On the other hand, if you don't, I don't know. It's just really hard.
All right. This episode of the Gabfest is brought to you by Sundance Now Doc Club, the new streaming service for everyone who loves documentaries. If you're like me and you like real stories, real people in extraordinary situations, or love learning about the world around you, then you will love Sundance Now Doc Club. Doc Club brings the human voice back to movie recommendations. Unlike other services, the documentary films in Doc Club are handpicked by expert programmers with unique perspectives or by cultural icons such as Ira Glass or Susan Sarandon. And their library of documentaries includes incredible stories of all types, including crime, history, politics, music, and sex. As a Sundance Now Doc Club member, you'll get exclusive benefits like free movie tickets, access to film festivals, award shows, and more. They asked me to curate a special program with my favorite documentary films, which I did. I had a really good time going through their catalog, and I've recommended a bunch before. But the one I'm going to recommend this week that I also recommended on my list is Harvard Beats Yale 29-29, a famous headline in the Harvard Crimson from a 1968 football game. You would think a 1968 football game between Harvard and Yale, really, who cares? Terrible football, like Ivy League scum. But it's a great documentary. It's about kind of America at a time of ferment. It's about these two, what's happening at these two elite colleges. It's about Doonesbury, like the whole birth of Doonesbury comes out at the same time. And the quarterback in this game at Yale is
Calvin character. Hill.
He's not the quarterback. He's the running back. The quarterback is Brian Dowling. Yeah, and Calvin Hill, who's a great character. Anyway, it's a fun, fun, fun movie. So you should check it out. For our audience members, Sundance Now Doc Club is offering a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to try out the service. Get your free 30-day trial at docclub.com/gabfest. That's docclub.com/gabfest. Okay, it's too soon to talk about this topic, and it's my fault. I saw all this frou-frou-rah, this drama about Guantanamo and President Obama having a plan to close Guantanamo, and I convinced John and Emily that we should talk about it today. But there's
suckers that we are.
The suckers that they are and ill-prepared. John was too busy in Iran. He was at Iran hearings. He was listening to Ernie Moniz.
It was amazing, by the way, just to interrupt your, how at the Iran hearing, it was actually by the standards of like show. There wasn't a lot of show, but the passive aggressivity and the little digs that various people were making at various times was,
Did Ernie Moniz bring any like super PhD knowledge, which he just dropped like boom?
Well, it's definitely, it was super useful for the administration to have him there because particularly on this question of 24 days of notice through the process when if Iran cheats at a non-nuclear site, If they cheat at a nuclear site, they'll be seen on the CCTVs that are going to be installed there. But if they cheat somewhere secret, then there's a 24-day process that the IAEA gets engaged in. And Benjamin Netanyahu and others have said, what, you'd never give your drug dealer, you know, if you're the cops, you'd never give a drug dealer 24 hours to flush away the crystal meth.
And Ernie, much less 24 days.
Yeah, sorry, I keep saying 24 hours, but 24 days. And Secretary Moniz has said many times, like, it ain't like that. So anyway, somebody at one point said, what's the half-life of uranium and plutonium? And he got so excited. He was like, oh, he said something like, you're tempting me to give, you know, a 20-minute answer, or maybe even said a day-long answer. But essentially, he said the half-life of uranium is about the history of the Earth, the idea being that you can't just hide uranium once you start cooking it up, that in fact, it's 24 days or 24 years, you're still going to find it.
Right. Right. That's why we have to, you know.
But it was useful to have him say that, because if Secretary Kerry had said that, they would have been like, oh, you're just a politician. Right. You're just trying to sell this deal. And he was also able to interject in a faster way to shut down some of the hyperbole, whereas if it had just been Kerry, people would have blown it off. But when he says, you know, that's not an accurate interpretation of the science, like, it carries a little more weight. And really, this is down to Democratic senators. Republican senators are unlikely to be swayed. But it was an interesting public relations benefit to expertise, which we have a big debate, of course, in our society about the power of science and who listens to it and so forth.
Okay, but that's not what we're talking about.
No, but I'm trying to filibuster.
I know. We're going to talk very briefly about President Obama's spokesman, Josh Earnest, said that the president is finalizing a plan to present to Congress to close Guantanamo Bay, which, of course, it was the prison camp there, which, of course, was a promise he made as a candidate back in 2007 and 2008. And he never carried it out for a variety of reasons, not least because Congress made it impossible for him to move any of the really bad prisoners anywhere or try them. Congress bars trials in U.S. courts, bars any of these Guantanamo prisoners from being brought into the U.S., bars, I think, even military tribunals in the U.S. for these prisoners. And so there is a certain category of prisoner, about half of those who are left, that the U.S. has cleared for transfer. They've said these people are not so dangerous, we think we can release them. But those half, most of them, they haven't been released, the ones that are still there. And then,
yeah, because they are all Yemenis, and Yemen is a mess. Nobody wants to send them to Yemen. It's not stable enough.
And the defense secretary who can release them has to be able to certify to Congress, oh, we think it's okay to release them. And the defense secretary, Ashton Carter, who I keep wanting to call Ashton Kutcher, but his name is
so
apparently,
me too.
His name is apparently Ashton Carter. He's not releasing them. But then there are the 70 or 80 folks who are presumably the real bad.
There are
the bad
more
ones.
Than 60 others. 10 of them have been charged with crimes, and about 54, I believe, have not.
So
also, there's legislation that, in addition to Carter, it's not just Carter's reluctance to answer the pressure from Susan Rice, who convened a special principals meeting on this question, principals being the relevant cabinet secretaries. It's that there's legislation that basically says Carter has to vouch for this personally. Right. I can't remember exactly how the modalities of that are, but he has to vouch for personally anybody that would come to the United States, because there's legislation that bars bringing any of the Gitmo detainees into the United States. So that's not likely to get things
very
far.
We are spending about $500 million a year, around $500 million a year for this prison camp, which is to house 100-odd people, really to house, you know, 70-odd people. So it's about $7 million a year for the real bad ones. Which is an absurd sum of money, just a ridiculously huge sum of money to pay. But why is there no chance this is going to happen?
Because Congress won't let it happen.
So what is it when the administration says it has a plan? What does it mean? They're just.
It means that President Obama made this a commitment, and he's going to keep trying and keep trying and keep trying till the end of his administration. I mean, here's my feeling is that, or my question to you, which is, what do you think the likelihood is that in 30 years, 27 years, you will be reading a piece in The New Yorker that is about the last Guantanamo prisoner? That they're basically
very high, because they're going to be there until they die.
That's
not
what I mean.
The 50-odd who we've cleared. Those people will eventually someday go home. But these other people,
yeah, that's what I mean.
It is so horrible. They are going to die there.
Why doesn't Obama do something? Here's what I would do if I were Obama. Now, this is clearly, there's definitely a reason why you can't do it, and I'm sure it's a terrible idea. But one of the problems is you have these people who are sitting. It's a very convenient. It's a U.S. base. It's like built. You know, it's got an infrastructure, and that makes it it makes a nice, easy solution. Why don't you take you can't bring these prisoners to the United States. Why don't you just put everyone on a boat? I think he could put
and
them
then
all
just
on boats.
Float it around the world. And they can be.
Yeah, and just, well, and just I mean, like he, embarrass us by having this thing floating around the ocean.
Because the problem is you embarrass yourself. It's your own country. I mean, right. It's not a very – the other thing is, like, this has been the problem for the president all along with Guantanamo since the very first day of his administration. It's an issue that ideally you would solve, and I think that it's clear that this is a stain on America's reputation abroad, but domestically, in terms of the politics, the payoff is just so small and not at all worth all the trouble of dealing with it. And so every time, it just seems like this isn't the thing that you actually expend political capital on.
Right.
Right. So you guys think 27 years we'll be reading about this. More than 27. Those prisoners are younger than we are.
Yeah,
I hope I'm not dead in 27 years.
Right. Well, you know, I just was trying to pick a number in the future.
I think the other thing I want to say about this is that of these 64 about people that we're talking about, only 10 are even facing charges. We have more than 50 people who have been held since the early 2002 against whom we have never brought a single criminal charge. And that is breathtaking. It's just such a detour from fairness, from every other assumption behind our criminal justice system. And it's really crazy.
It's such an embarrassment because it's clear we can have these trials. They'd be perfectly fine. They would work. I mean, except we torture these people so that evidentiary issues would be a problem. What if the president just gave back the land?
Well, Cuba wants it. Mm.
I don't think
the prisoners convey? I mean,
yeah, I was wondering if you just give it back.
Know.
I don't think they wouldn't convey. You wouldn't want that to.
All right.
Obama had a list of things that he could never actually do, but if he was going to pretend that he wasn't a grown-up on the last day in office, like he could also let out of prison, you know, everyone who has an overly long sentence, and we'd just have tens of thousands of people getting out.
You know, he could just do something that just excites a confrontation to, you know, make one last public push as a way of laying down a marker for something he believes. That could be what his plan is. I mean, that it's not a plan that he thinks will work, but the one he wants to go through.
Are they legal? I guess he couldn't just bring Khalid Sheikh Mohammed or somebody to New York and just put him on trial. They're legally barred from doing it.
I think that's right. I don't know how the legislation works. Yeah, I think.
Yeah, didn't they end up passing? Didn't Congress actually? Yeah. I mean, Eric Holder withdrew that idea on his own. Let's be clear. He pulled out of that himself. But then I think Congress might have made it impossible anyway.
Oh, well. Sorry for that brief abortive discussion. We should have talked about Ernie Moniz. Ernie Moniz, potential Hillary Clinton vice presidential candidate.
What state's he
you
from?
You think?
I don't know what state he's from. He's from the state of. He's from Mars, man. He's from like some other. He's from a different.
I guess Massachusetts.
Is Mars
MIT,
a swing state? So. Is that a battleground? I think it's not a battleground.
It's a red planet.
It's a red state.
You see the red, the joke
yes!
there is the colors. You see,
boom.
You get that. It's very neat.
Yes, and women are from Venus. Blue. That's a blue. They can win.
I'm hanging up on you.
Come on. Oh, my
Venus.
God. John's red planet was so good. That was a great line.
Yeah, he John's just... joke was funny. Yours is just merely sexist.
Oh.
Come on. All right. Summer's here. It means you're too busy firing up the grill and sunning in the sand to even think about setting foot in a mall. The problem is you still need to look fresh as John Dickerson looks every day. Trunk Club gets it. That's why they've taken the hassle out of shopping by shipping you a trunk of clothes that fit perfectly and make you look like $1 million. At trunkclub.com/gabfest, you answer simple questions about your style, preferences, and size, and are then assigned an expert stylist who handpicks clothes curated from the best premium brands that are perfect for you. You pick what you like, and just like that, a trunk full of handpicked clothes arrives at your door. You pay only for the clothes that you keep. No ongoing subscription, no hidden charges, just great clothes. And right now, the service is completely free. Get started at trunkclub.com/gabfest. That's trunkclub.com/gabfest. Have a great summer with Trunk Club. One more time, it's trunkclub.com/gabfest. Let's turn to cocktail chatter. John, when you are having a really, really cold gin and tonic, which I think might be something you'd have, what are you going to be chattering about?
It might be something I have right after we're done with the show. So I'm going to chatter about the sad case of James A. Garfield. who was attacked on July 2nd, 1881 by an assassin. And the reason I looked into this was that in Whistle Stop this week, it was about the challenge to Jimmy Carter by Ted Kennedy, which would have been, sorry, did I say 76? 1980. So Carter gets challenged, and in 1976, Reagan challenged Ford, and those were two efforts to unseat an incumbent from the nomination of their party. And the last person that it happened to was Chester Arthur. And I'm a fan of Chester Arthur, largely because of his extraordinary facial hair. It's an amazing thing. Go Google Chester Arthur and just the different varieties of things that he let grow on his face. Anyway, Chester Arthur was the last president who was not nominated by his party after being the incumbent. And the reason he was in office at all is because James Garfield was assassinated. Okay, so Garfield's assassinated in the his 4 months, but what 4 months into office. But what struck me about Garfield was a couple of just random interesting facts. First of all, the fellow who shot him, Charles, and I think it's Guiteau, maybe is how you pronounce it. He basically was mentally unstable, but the initiating event that created his instability is he wrote what he thought was like this awesome speech in support of Ulysses S. Grant, David's favorite president. And he thought the speech was so good that he should be given a patronage post as a result of this speech. He printed the speech himself. He was sort of a blogger who felt like his speech, which then he thought had been used, should like get him a job. So he was basically just like an angry blogger who thought he should get a post, a job because of a post he'd written. So he then goes through a few more mental gymnastics and decides that Garfield should pay for him not getting this job. So Garfield is shot in the back. He's shot twice, but the real bad one for him is when he's shot in the back. But then he lives for months and months afterwards. And so there is this national kind of waiting game and also obsession with his health. And what's so tragic is that basically while Garfield is in the White House suffering, the doctors are constantly trying to find the bullet that is still in him. The thing is, there's no sense of hygiene back then. And so the doctors are basically rooting around in his back, like with their fingers, making him more worse, right? Giving him blood poisoning, giving him all kinds. So Garfield is not even shot and is going in and out of delirium, but like he's getting sicker and sicker the more the doctors mess with him. At one point, they bring Alexander Graham Bell brings in something called an induction balance, which is it looks like an old-fashioned joystick that they moved over him to try and find out where the bullet was. And it didn't find out where the bullet was. It was supposed to make a ping that would go that. So I guess kind of like looking for coins on the beach. It turns out that something I read said that if he hadn't been in the metal frame bed that he was in, that they would have found it.
Yep.
So that, in fact, the Graham Bell's device worked. Anyway, the physical ailments that piled upon Garfield during his months and months of slow death are really so grim, which they discovered all of this after he had finally expired. And then, of course, they sort of, after he was dead, the supposed tile that he fell on at the railroad station when he was shot became a kind of a celebrated curiosity that people would, like after Lincoln's assassination, hoard and great value was given to those things that kind of had touched Garfield along his way towards death. The thing that just struck me was that so many months spent in this slow death.
I think Garfield's death is one of those historical cusp moments that America would have been somewhat different without him dying. He was an incredible figure. He was had been a college president at the age of 20 or 25 or something, and had been a military hero, you know, an abolitionist, and he was a really heroic, interesting, charismatic guy. And I think people thought he would have been a really interesting, good president, and he was cut short. One of my kids asked me today whether Garfield Street, which is around the corner from us in Washington, was named after the cat Garfield.
Well,
that's
possible if it had been named recently. Garfield the cat is certainly more famous today in America.
James Garfield.
Oh, by the way, also one other side note is that when Garfield was in his decline at the White House, because he was in fever so much, they developed one of the first forms of air conditioning, which is that they took a huge block of ice and then had fans blow over the ice. So that was one other technological innovation that came as a result of this.
Emily. What is your president and presidential death chatters? What do you got?
As I stand next to a block of ice, I want to recommend a podcast that Tablet Magazine put up this week. It's called The Man Who Rescued or Stole French Jewish History, and it's about a book by the historian Lisa Leff. The book is called The Archive Thief, and it's this crazy story of this historian who was very respected, and he was working on the history of Jews in France. And after the Second World War, he started creeping around to different libraries and ripping pages out of manuscripts and documents and stealing them. These pages mostly ended up in archives in other countries, in the US and Israel. And so the question is, you know, did he rescue French Jewish history, or did he completely sabotage it? And what do we make of this transfer of documents and how it's changed the scholarship about this period? It was just a really interesting historical kind of detective story. So go check it out.
Cool. My chatter, not so high-minded. I, in the joyful summer TV watching with my children, I just have to give a word of praise to American Ninja Warrior, which we watch, which I think is just it's a great show. It really showcases average everyday people who have made themselves into incredible athletes and who are setting themselves quite difficult challenges. It's delightful to watch, and the people are incredible physical specimens. So if you haven't seen it, I strongly recommend it. Great show to TiVo, because there's a lot of downtime that you can just fast forward through. Our intern is Tarek Barrett. Our producer is Mike Volo. Our managing producer is Joel Meyer. Andy Bowers is the executive producer of Slate Podcasts. The GabFest is part of the Panoply Network, whose entire roster of podcasts can be checked out at itunes.com/panoply. Our show page is slate.com/GabFest. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/GabFest. And our Twitter feed is @SlateGabFest. Email address is gabfest@slate.com. We have a live show in Washington next Wednesday, July 29th. We look forward to seeing many of you there. Sold out, so there are no more tickets, but we're really looking forward to it. It's going to be a fun night. For Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. We'll talk to you next week.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.